Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Boomer and the Vape Show, giving voice to 78 million boomers from coast to coast and border to border. Each day we have a different guest and a different topic. Our guests always have a nugget or two for anyone, regardless of where you are. We hope you enjoy the relaxed conversational style of the show. Nothing fancy, just boomers sitting around the table talking about stuff. Now, here are the Boomer and the Vape, Pete Peters and Deborah Brown.
Yes, indeed, it is the Boomer the Babe Show on Blog Talk Radio. It is Tuesday, June 28th, 2011, and we are broadcasting from our studio in the Feeding Arizona Complex in Youngtown, Arizona. And we're going to be getting to our guest here in just a minute, but before I do, I want to invite all of our listeners to take a look at our website, www.boomerandthebabe.com. That's boomerandthebabe.com. Take a little tour around. Watch for some of the new things that are coming. We're going to have some new free offers on that website here very shortly, so keep watching for it. In addition to this radio show, we also publish mini books and ebooks, and our authors have their own shows right here on the Boomer and the Babe Network on Blog Talk Radio. So you can go to Boomer and the Babe, Blog Talk Radio / Boomer and Babe. That's Blog Talk Radio / Boomer and Babe. And you can take a look and see who our other authors are, as well as who our show hosts are. And we invite you to listen to those folks as well. Always good information with those fine authors and show hosts. My guest today, first of all, Deborah's not here right now. Deborah's going to be in later, doing a little other office work at the other office, and she'll be in here before long to do some videotaping with me. But right now, it's just me and our guest, who is Mr. Ken Rice. Ken Rice is the fire marshal for Sun City Fire Department. And he's been with us before. We always have a lot of fun when Ken's here. Even though it's a serious topic, we have an enjoyable conversation. So, Ken, welcome to the Boomer the Babe Show.
Thank you, sir. Pleasure to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you, believe me. I'd like you to give us a little bit of indication as to how you became the fire marshal for Sun City, Arizona. What is your background a little bit, and what brings you to this position today?
Background, a former police officer with the city of Glendale. I worked as a risk manager for the municipal risk retention pool for the state of Arizona. I worked in the town of Youngtown as a building inspector and risk manager and loss control coordinator. And that's when I came to be in contact with Sun City Fire, kept a relationship with them. And when their fire marshal saw that he was going to retire, I came on board as a deputy to be trained up to be their fire marshal.
How long ago was that?
I just entered my sixth year with Sun City.
Fantastic.
Yeah, love it.
And loving every minute of it.
Roger that.
What makes Sun City different from some of the other places?
Unique. Sun City, we cover a portion of unincorporated Maricopa County. Our entire fire district is about 22 square miles. Within that, we have Sun City, which is obviously a retirement community. We have Youngtown, which was America's first retirement community. Not many people know that. Which is now a multi-family community. And then we cover Citrus Point, which is about an 800-home subdivision, 115th and Bell on the south side of the road. So we have a lot of diverse people and different demographics, in addition to about 1,300 businesses that we have to tend to.
What are some of the more unique things that you've come across as the fire marshal for Sun City?
I think one of the most unique aspects is our fire investigations, which I think we're going to talk on the second half of the show. It's just fascinating. I didn't know that we'd be entering the realm of forensic science, but we do that every fire investigation we go on.
So are you the CSI of the fire department?
I wouldn't go that far.
Well, that's one of the reasons, of course, that you're here is that we wanted to discuss the new law as it pertains to fireworks in the state of Arizona. And I'm assuming that a lot of people know about it. I don't know how many people are planning on going out, taking advantage of it, and purchasing fireworks legally in the state of Arizona for the first time ever, I guess it is. But give us a thumbnail sketch of when that law came into effect, how it came into effect, and was it an oh, by the way, or had people been working on it for some time?
My understanding is that law has been trying to be passed for quite some time. It's been vetoed numerous times. It was signed into law. It became effective December 1st, 2010. I don't know that many consumers even knew it was out there being talked about. I think when they first found out is when they saw the displays for sale at a lot of the retail establishments.
Now, you and I were talking before the show, and you were talking about some displays for sale, and you said that a lot of these retail establishments apparently are going to put up a separate little tent or something maybe outside of their facility. Explain what you're telling me.
I think what you're going to see, or probably already seen if you drive around the valley, you'll see that there'll be displays within retail establishments. You'll see that there'll be small tents in the parking lot, and then you'll see some very large, in excess of 800 square foot tents that will sell these fireworks throughout the valley. The larger parking lots, closed up business parking lots, I've seen them all over.
Well, you know what this reminds me of? When I was a wee lad, let's say, and we would travel from Michigan down to Florida to visit Granddad, and we would come be down the highway, and there, all of a sudden, depending on what state you were in, are this free fireworks for sale here, the big tents, gaudy signs, M80s. I mean, they're just spelling out on these big signs, cherry bombs, whatever it is that you could buy. And I know for a fact that some of my friends in Michigan would drive down to the first roadside stand they could find, load up with fireworks, and take them back to Michigan and sell those suckers to other friends and try to make a dollar. But is that kind of an appearance? Is that, do you think we're going to be looking at that kind of a thing?
Already have. Yeah, there's no shortage of the big gaudy tents with the signs everywhere. The fireworks companies typically provide all that at no charge to the vendor, and then they take a cut. So you'll, as a nonprofit or even a for-profit vendor, can contact these folks, or they'll contact you. They typically supply the tent, the permitting, the fireworks, the generator, all that stuff. You really need just to supply manpower, and then you get a percentage of what you sell, and they pick up what you don't. The things that are not legal are aerial devices, something that's going to leave the ground, or something that's going to explode, firecrackers, that type of stuff. Consumer fireworks are spelled out what they need to be, and they're typically, they'll make some noise, they'll have showers of sparks that are expelled from when they're ignited.
But no such things as cherry bombs and M80s that blow up mailboxes.
M80s are actually federal. If you have M80s, the folks from the ATF will probably come talk to you because that's a federal offense.
Oh, it is?
Yeah. Oh, M80s are bad. If you have them, I wouldn't use them.
Yeah, it's minor league bomb, is it?
Yeah, M80s are not good.
But, I mean, you used to be able to get those packs of fireworks for firecrackers, and you just light the fuse on one end, and they just sit there and just almost like a machine gun sound.
No firecrackers. Firecrackers are still illegal.
Okay. Bottle rockets are illegal.
Bottle rockets are illegal.
So anybody that is selling those,
They're bound to be in a world of trouble because that's going to, like I said, once get into the, you're probably going to get a visit from some federal folks, at least state level. You can't sell, the only thing you can legally sell is what's considered the consumer fireworks.
And those are the ones that just go whir and buzz.
Yeah, they large showers of sparks that come out, they whiz, they pop a little bit, but they don't explode, they don't leave the ground. And they do, part of the law is they have to remain in the packaging that they come in. So if you're going to go to these tents and there's things that are not in the package, either they've been taken out illegally or they're not the right kind of fireworks. It says there's a seal on it. It says consumer fireworks, safe and sane. And I believe it's a seal from the California State Fire Marshal's office. So they're fairly easy to indicate what you're buying. One of my biggest fears is that people are going to bring in non-legal or illegal fireworks that pose a significant danger because they do explode or leave the ground, and they're going to put those in the tent with the so-called safe and sane consumer firework. And then you may be taking them home, purchasing them, not realizing that those are illegal, putting yourself not only in danger of injury or death, but also prosecution.
Is safe and sane really safe and sane?
Boy, that's a tricky question. I think that if they're used per the manufacturer recommendation, I don't foresee a a huge problem. I know that a lot of us, especially the guys in the audience, are probably not really good at manufacturers' recommendations and directions, and our wives will probably agree to that. Like I said, once again, if they're used like they tell you to use them, and they're supposed to have handouts there to tell you what's safe, I think you're okay. I think when we go outside of those realms, then we're going to have some issues.
But anytime you're striking a match to anything, you've got a potential problem. Is that really an accurate statement?
Yeah, I think it's totally accurate. And I think that if we look around, we've burned up 700,000 plus acres of Arizona already this year in a short amount of time. We've expended a huge amount of resources and even larger amount of money to put out these fires. I don't know if it's the perfect time. Maricopa County instituted a ban June 17th, so you're not even allowed to use them in unincorporated areas of Maricopa County until that ban's lifted. It was part of their open burn, but they specifically listed consumer fireworks on there. So they can't be used right now.
Okay, in unincorporated
Maricopa County.
Maricopa County.
And then each city will have its own restriction on use. So
let's take as an example, Sun City, Arizona.
Illegal. Per Maricopa County.
They are not incorporated. They are not incorporated.
Correct.
So then anywhere out there in the county, that you're just out there in the woods or...
It's illegal right now.
It's illegal as we speak.
Correct.
Lake Pleasant.
It depends on what part of the lake you're in. Maricopa County part is incorporated in the city of Peoria. And I believe Peoria has some pretty heavy restrictions. I'd recommend they go to each city's website to find out what use, if any, is allowed.
Well, this whole issue of fireworks is another incident of some place and something that needs to be enforced.
Correct.
Something that needs to be investigated, followed up, and so on and so forth. Who does that? Ken Rice?
Ken Rice for the Sun City Fire District, and then all my compadres out there all across the valley. The problem was when the budgets were reduced due to the recession, a lot of those enforcement people were let go. So you don't have, I believe that you, there is a permitting that goes into place, so we have fees, but if we don't have the people to pay to go out and inspect them, you know, it's a lengthy process. NFPA 1124 is the code that was adopted by the state fire marshal that we have to enforce. It's not a thick code, but there's a lot of information to try and digest in there, and we have to apply that. So every stand that opens or every retail establishment that wants to sell these consumer fireworks, they have to first get a permit, and we issue the permit, then we have to go and make sure it's set up correctly, they have the right fire extinguishers, spacing from buildings, spacing from other combustibles, how they're storing the stock on hand that's not on display. There's a lot to it.
So the chances of somebody doing something untoward and getting away with it, you'd like to think certainly that they're not going to be able to get away with it.
Correct.
But in reality, there is a manpower shortage, a womanpower shortage.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, personnel, the industry as a whole in the fire service is very limited on the folks that can, A, understand the code, digest it, and apply it, and just go out and be able to do it, in addition to all the other scope of what they do during their day-to-day activities. It's going to be difficult to keep an eye on these folks every day to make sure that somebody hasn't brought in illegal fireworks to sell.
Well, yeah, bringing in the illegal fireworks, because they can
sure.
They can bring them in and there's really nobody's going to – they don't get monitored at the state line.
Oh, no.
And any more than other things get monitored
absolutely.
State line. So, I mean, it's going to be another case of something illegal coming into this.
Yeah, and like I said, my biggest fear on that is somebody obtaining those not knowing what they've purchased and then thinking that they're the safe and sane firework and they're not. And then, you know, somebody gets their fingers blown off or has a critical burn injury or is killed because of it. It's too late then.
Well, I was watching some television earlier this morning, and I came up with, I guess it was the United States Fire Marshal or the Arizona Fire Marshal.
Yeah, there's the Arizona State Fire Marshal, and we have an organization, the Arizona Fire Marshals Association.
Yeah, there was a public service announcement with regard to the fireworks.
Uh-huh.
And he was saying that az-fireworks.com okay. spells everything out so that anybody that is interested in finding out exactly more than what we're having the ability to talk about here today, they can go to az-fireworks.com and they can find. I'm looking at the site right now. I've got it up. There's all kinds of stuff on there. I mean, if I started going through this site, you and I wouldn't have a conversation. I'd be having my head buried in the computer.
Yeah.
The whole aspect of fireworks as to whether or not – now, this – I may be asking you for an opinion here that you may not be wanting to give.
I'm pretty good with opinions.
I know you are. Is this a case of a law that passed and it wasn't really well thought out?
Yeah, I don't know if it was – there was pieces of it I think were not well thought out. Sales to 16-year-olds I have a huge personal issue with, being a parent of three. I'm in full agreement with free enterprise. People make a profit, sell their goods. I think there's got to be some more responsibilities associated with that. I believe that there probably should have been a fund set up for burn injuries that are going to be connected with this, and that money distributed somehow to, you know, probably the, you know, we have one of the best, finest burn treatment centers in the nation over at Maricopa. You know, I don't know that enough players came to the table. You know, probably if we in the industry, in the fire marshals industry and the folks on the burn injury side, if everybody probably could have had more of a seat at the table and really talked through it, I think there was some lines drawn in the sand that got crossed. I think we could have crafted a lot better legislation rather than just say, you know, the website's beautiful. How many people are going to read it? I mean, you're going to be riding down the road with the kids, or the high school kids are going to ride down the road and go, hey, let's go buy some fireworks. My fear is we have a whole carload full of them. Something gets lit, and then we have a catastrophic event occur in a vehicle or in somebody's home. I don't think that many – I think the responsible folks will maybe go to the website and see what's legal, not legal. I don't know that some of our youth will delve that deep into it.
If they have a bent for irresponsibility, they're going to be irresponsible here as long as with anything else that they
anything
do.
Else, yep.
Anything else. Anything else.
Driving too fast, drinking and driving, yes, lighting fireworks off in the car. Right. You know, there's that group of people, and that's my fear is that spills over into the responsible, vulnerable folks.
And it affects the responsible vulnerable folks.
Yes. Yeah.
And they're the ones that, in many cases, get the brunt of it.
Yeah. Because we have to pay for all those damages.
Yes.
Much like the wall of fire and the campfire that was left behind.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we as taxpayers are going to come up with probably in the neighborhood of $10 to $15 million to cover that because of irresponsibility.
That's pretty amazing. Let's go back to the 16-year-old thing again. We were talking about this at some length before the show. So it's really the case where anyone, any age, can use or possess.
Yeah, if you look at other statutes, like with tobacco and alcohol, there's an age limit to purchase, use, and possess. That never happened with this legislation. It was 16. There was talk about changing it to 18. My understanding is it's still 16. I definitely have an inherent problem with people under the age of 18 being able to purchase, use, and possess these. Now, if you're in, you know, the company of your parent, somebody responsible that understands a little more about burn injuries, burn preventions, I'm okay with that. You know, if you want to take Junior out and show him how the firework looks in the middle of the night, great. I mean, we built this nation on freedoms. But with freedom becomes, you need responsibility. I just wish they would have crafted that a little bit better. So when law enforcement runs into the 14-year-olds that are lighting them off, they can do something.
Yeah,
they can't.
Right now they can't.
You know, unless the use is prohibited in your city or town or county, it just leaves kind of an open door right there.
So the 16-year-old brother can go out and buy whatever they're going to buy, and then give them to the 12 and the 14, sure. 12 and the 14-year-old brother and sister to go out and sure. and have whatever fun they want to supposedly yeah. have with them. And nobody's there to supervise those kids.
Right. And I didn't read the website before we came down. I don't know that they changed it to 18. There was talk about it, but I don't think that ever happened. I think they left it at at 16 for the purchase.
Well, as
I could be wrong.
Yeah, I'll kind of look through here and see if they have a who can do type of situation.
Yeah.
The fireworks in and of themselves that are just the ones that go whir and spin mm-hmm. and buzz and shoot sparks, they, with as dry as we are and as dry as any house is nowadays or is in Arizona, are in and of themselves quite a threat, aren't they?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we did an experiment, and because, like I said, one of my fears is that they have a box in the car, and it's kids riding down the road. And so we took an old car, not that old, and I opened one of the large packages and spread them out through the rear of the vehicle, and we ignited two of the fireworks. And we had that car fully involved in flames in about 2 minutes. As they all were going off, they ignited the seat cushions and took the balance of the car. So I just wanted to see if we could recreate that, if my fears were just or imagine it, my imagination run wild, which they were just because we were able to ignite the car with fireworks. That's it.
And that proved to be the case. Not about it. Well, if you were to give somebody a one or two sentence or thoughts as far as the operation of the fireworks, whether or not where they could use, how they could use, what would your elevator speech message be with regard to use of fireworks in Arizona?
I would follow the manufacturer's instructions and I would give full parental supervision when you use them.
Okay, there it is. Manufacturer's instructions and full supervision. Absolutely. Sounds like a plan to me. Let's talk a little bit now about something else that I know that we were going to talk about today, and that's this the fire investigations team. Now, that's something else that you're heavily involved in,
yes.
Correct? Now, what is the background of the fire investigations team? How did that – has that always been in Sun City, or is that something that's relatively new, something that's come on since you've been here?
The teams are relatively new. We had one fire investigator when I came on board, and that was Captain Brett Mills. Phenomenal investigator, trained up at state and national level. Very, very good investigator. His gear was kept in a locker down at Station 132. So we saw the need to have to bring a higher level of professionalism to that. So I met with the chiefs. I met with Captain Mills, and we talked about where we wanted to go with the team. One of our visions, or Brett's visions, was to have six investigators. Well, we looked through the ranks, and we have some extremely talented people here at the fire department. But budget, we always want to be cognizant of the budget because, you know, the folks out here were an ad valorem tax, so the homeowners and the property owners pay for our department. But we don't want to just throw money to the wind, and we want a nice, viable product. So we thought, how can we do that? Well, we thought, well, we'll interview folks, and there'll be myself, Captain Mills, and then we'll pick five other folks that want to do fire investigations. But with that, they are on call but not paid to be on call. We have myself, Captain Brett Mills, Captain Dave Girard, Engineer Sandy Young, Engineer Dale Gillespie, and then we have Firefighter Eric Archer and Blake Miller. Throughout the interview process, we told them, and when we pick people, we're going to arrange for your training because we can get them trained at the National Fire Academy at no charge to the taxpayers. That's all federal money. But we expect you to be on call, but we can't pay you to be on call. And they were okay with that. When they do come out, if they're on shift, it's just their shift time. If they come out off shift, they are paid overtime, which is fair, and we need to pay them to be there. But we bill the insurance companies for the investigation, which was a piece many people didn't
do. There you go. That's very interesting.
So what we did is we came up with a per-hour fee to have two investigators. And that's spelled out. NFPA 921 is the guide to fire and explosion investigations. We utilize that heavily. It's actually more of a standard now than a guide. It's somehow grown in the eyes of the law and the judges as a standard. So we need two people to do the fire investigation. So whatever time they spend, resources, that gets billed to the homeowners or business owners insurance company. So we try and offset that cost. So we really don't have much of a cost. Well, one of the other things we needed was somewhere for the equipment. It was amazing how much equipment you use during a fire investigation. It's like taking a jigsaw puzzle, setting it on fire, and running it through a shredder. And then we got to put it back together to figure out what it looked like before before the fire. If you've ever been into a fire, you can look and go, how do they do that? So we needed a trailer. So I contacted two of our wonderful community partners, Adult Care Assistance, Karen Willard over there, and then Heritage Palmares. And I said, hey, I need a trailer. Do you guys want to sponsor the trailer, i.e. buy it for me? And they were 100% on board. We picked out a trailer, picked out the equipment. They wrote me the checks, and we bought this nice little 6x10 trailer. We have all the equipment in there. We have a pop-up awning. We have chairs to take if we need to take a break. We're usually out there about 5-6 hours, and days like yesterday kind of wears on you a little bit. We have coolers in there. We have shovels, rakes, electrical testing equipment, cameras, you name it, a portable generator, lights. We got it all in one trailer. So it's really just evolved into this, you know, we have a 7-member investigations team. We have a larger team than most of the big cities. Not Phoenix. Phoenix is huge, but it just worked out really well. We did last year. We did 15 investigations. That's Sun City. You know, we did two out of the jurisdiction of Sun City. We did 15 investigations this year. We're just coming to the end of June. We've already done 15. So. We've tied last year, and we're at the end of June.
What creates or how is the need for an investigation determined? Is every fire investigated?
Anything we determine to be a working fire. So if the crews get there, what happens is they'll get reported out of, say, a structure fire. They'll come in. You'll see smoke coming from the neighbor's patio. So that's going to come in as either a reported working fire or a structure fire, house fire. The crews will get there. It'll be a 3-in-1 assignment. They'll get there. If it is truly a fire, not like the neighbor's barbecue, then our team, all 7 members, get paged. We've already decided who's on what week, who's going to go type thing. And then we roll 2 or 3 investigators out to the scene. And when we get there, we take over the scene from the operations folks. They can go back, get the rest they need. We have scene control. We are allowed to do that exigent circumstance. I'm sure you're familiar with that. That gives us the authority to investigate that fire. Reasons we do it, to determine origin and cause. We need to find that out to see if there is a mechanical issue with certain pieces of equipment that could be out in the field. Do we have an arsonist running wild, lighting stuff on fire? There's a whole multitude of reasons why we do the investigation, but the authority is the exigent circumstance, which is the same authority that gives the firefighters the authority to go in and extinguish the fire. It's granted to us to take that scene and do a thorough, prompt investigation to determine the origin and the cause of the fire.
Not unlike a crime scene investigation.
Correct. Identical.
So only this one involves fire.
Correct.
Okay. Now, I know from firsthand knowledge, because it happened down the street from me, there was a gentleman that apparently drove himself through his house and into his pool, and whatever the circumstances were, it was all natural, as I understand it. But is that a fire scene, or is that a police scene?
Well, the first portion of that is going to be fire. They'll have command and control. They'll take care of that, do the rescue. I understand that. I think Peoria attempted a rescue in the pool to get the gentleman out. Once the rescue's done, we get the house shored up, then you're going to see the county, Maricopa County Sheriff, or wherever the jurisdiction is. Then the law enforcement, they're going to be there. But depending on the circumstance, they need to come in and do their portion of the investigation to find out what happened. Was it natural? Was it a crime? Was it a suicide? Anytime there's a death, they have to determine, or an accident, what happened. If there's a fire, we obviously have command and control there. We get the fire out. They call our team in. We start our origin and cause determination. If it is looking to be a criminal offense, which we would call an incendiary fire, arson is actually a legal term. It's not a type of a fire. Then we will stop. we'll contact Maricopa County's arson task force or their arson team to come out, and then we'll work in concert to determine the origin and cause with them. They have the legal authority to pursue the criminal act. We don't. So we'll just stop. Two of us on the team have former law enforcement backgrounds. So we just put the brakes on, seal it up, give them a call, and they'll come out. And sometimes when they come out, absolutely, it was an incendiary fire, arson was committed, and we'll pursue that. Or we put our heads together and figure out that, well, it may have looked not right at the beginning. Once we sift through it, we start to figure out, and with during interviews, that it was truly an accidental fire. There's only four types: accidental, incendiary, natural, and undetermined. Natural's lightning strike. I've done one of those in my 2 years. And it was actually down in the city of Tolleson. We went and helped those folks out. Most of them we're going to find to be accidental. I did one the other day. The fan was left running. It melted down and short circuit, caught the carpet on fire, spread over to a chair, caught the chair on fire, caught the room on fire. Now, undetermined's where we just don't know. We think we know, but the interesting thing is, if you're familiar with the scientific method, that's what we have to use to do an investigation. So we define the problem, develop a hypothesis, test that hypothesis to see if it's any good. Sometimes we have to call it undetermined because remember that jigsaw puzzle I talked about? That piece is not there. And I can't find that piece, so I can't say that it was 100% accidental. I just can't. I'm not comfortable.
It's not a situation of beyond a reasonable doubt.
Correct.
It has to be 100% proven to be the case.
Yeah, and we have to test that. And typically on a big house fire, we'll get an accident. We'll get a private origin and cause investigator come in from the insurance company. They have a lot more expendable resources, so we can bring in metallurgists, we can bring in forensic electrical engineers, we can bring in, they just have a whole plethora of resources that we're not going to spend money on. And then we'll even work with the privates. Love working with them because they're very knowledgeable. Most of them are retired guys that picked up that as their retirement gig. Big checkbook, lots of resources.
Deep pocket.
And we can really test some of these theories. We had one up north. The guy was sweating some pipe, the neighbor caught some wall insulation on fire. So we actually recreated that in the driveway. It was neat. We were able to develop a hypothesis and test it and see if that torch at that distance would ignite the paper on insulation. Absolutely.
I'll be darned.
So it's just a fascinating field to be in.
I'm going to throw a hypothetical into this situation that I mentioned earlier about the gentleman that had some sort of a difficulty and drove his car through the house.
Sure.
If that had ignited a fire on his pass through his home, how would that have changed the reactions and who does what?
Well, we'd have been called in the investigation scene. Once the fire was put out, we'd have been called in. Because we still need to determine, did the vehicle passing through somehow ignite some combustible material that ignited the home, or was the fire ignited prior to the vehicle passing through? Maybe that was the, we don't know who started it, why it started, when it started. You'll see those sometimes where somebody will light a fire to cover up a homicide. I know one in Glendale. I know one in Phoenix. They think that the fire scene, the fire will destroy all the evidence of the burglary or the homicide or the, some of those things where it doesn't.
It just doesn't.
It doesn't. And I doubt those folks are listening right now, but it doesn't work.
And when they try to beat the system, it's kind of tough to beat the system, isn't it?
Anymore, it's extremely tough.
Especially when they've got all of this other information at your disposal.
Yeah.
All of the technology at your disposal. just wealth of knowledge that's just there for you
and
fellows
and
to tap into and time.
Plenty of time.
You're not in a rush.
Yeah. I can take a year to do a fire investigation.
There you go.
Then if you put the insurance companies with them helping out, they have, they don't have to pay the claim until they have to pay the claim. Let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to cooperate with everybody, or they're not going to pay the claim.
Right.
And if it's some criminal act, you not only have the fire investigators work in that, which a lot of them are former law enforcement or current law enforcement, and they're cross-trained. If it's homicide, you have homicide guys working at it. If it's a property crime, you have. So there's a lot of people looking at it. Right? Probably not going to get away with it.
It's not going to happen.
Pretty difficult.
Not going to happen. We've already discussed, or you've already mentioned, that you do help other jurisdictions. And how does that come about? How is it that Sun City Fire, this little Sun City Fire Department, with their obviously wonderful investigations team, goes out and helps other jurisdictions? Is it because you're so darn good?
I'd like to think so. No, I have to. Probably the two people the most responsible for that are actually the seven. Our two chiefs, Chief Hainer, Chief Olson. Embrace that. Our board of elected officials embraced it. We have what's called automatic aid with operations. So if there's a big fire, we'll get jurisdictions from everywhere. We'll get Phoenix, Glendale, Surprise, El Mirage, Sun City West. Whatever we need shows up. So I talked to the chiefs, and not only with our public education, but we expanded it to our fire investigation team. So if we have a city or a district that doesn't have the resources that we've been blessed to have and the people that we have, I thought, well, why can't we just tow the trailer on down? I'm salaried, so no matter where I go or how many hours I work, my pay is set. We should be able to go and help those folks come up with the same origin and cause that we do. Being in the Arizona Fire Marshals Association, we're pretty good. The chiefs are all part of the Arizona Fire Chiefs. So we just put out the word that, hey, we have seven investigators. Everybody's trained. Several of us are certified. We have a trailer. We have equipment. We'll come over your town and help out. We're not going to take over. I got called out to Tolleson on an extremely large arson of an apartment. Somebody lit a lower apartment on fire. That was a very large one. We actually had Phoenix bring their dog out on that one, their accelerant detection dog. Then we were down in Tolleson on the lightning strike. So any city, town, or district that needs our help, we can be paged out. Phoenix, the alarm room, they know our call sign. So if that jurisdiction says, hey, I need car 133, then they'll just page me in the middle of the night and we'll hook up the trailer and go. But without the support of the chiefs and the board, never would have happened. And not only does it help the other jurisdictions, it makes our people sharper.
Right.
Every fire you do, you learn a little bit more. So if I can get them out in the field to do, we have an open invitation from the city of Phoenix to go train with their guys anytime we can get over there. And if we do that, our guys go on our shift. Maybe spend 12 hours over there out of a 48-hour shift. So they're already being paid. It's not shorting our department, but it's certainly enhancing their skill levels far beyond what you're ever going to get in a classroom.
So it's safe to say that all the fire departments, probably all the chiefs, all the fire marshals, there is a true sharing of assets.
Oh, absolutely.
Is it a case where you go out and let's see, you at a Tolleson, you do something at Tolleson, and do you bill Tolleson then for that?
No, it's all based on reciprocities.
Automatic aid is
probably one of the best systems ever been created. All our trucks are on GPS. Everybody that's part of that automatic aid, I don't know, I think there's 30 departments maybe. All the calls go into Phoenix. Everybody that's part of automatic, the Phoenix alarm room will dispatch whatever's needed. So depending on the size, scope of the incident, we can get cranes out there. We can get, you name it, we can get them on scene. It's whoever's the closest to that scene is going to get dispatched.
And it could be the closest while they're out on the road doing something else too, correct?
If they're available, once they clear the call they're on, they put themselves back as available through the computer, it will tell Phoenix that truck is available and that truck has this capability. It's a ladder truck with pump capabilities, or it's an engine with they can do vehicle extrication, or it's an engine with They can do technical response with water rescue. Phoenix Alarm Room knows all that. Every truck, they know what the capabilities. So when these incidents start to unfold, they send the... That's why you go, oh, my God, why do we have, you know, 15 fire trucks there? But if you look at the big recycle yard fires, you got 40, 50 pieces of apparatus, but you need them. And as they don't need them, they can kick them loose. But if you need them, you really like to have them there.
If you need them, you need them.
You know, fires, it's typical, going to grow, double about every 30 seconds. So little fires turn into big fires really fast. So you want a lot of people there to handle that. If you don't need them, you kick them loose. So we thought, well, yeah, we should share all our assets. I have a public educator that's very good, very passionate about, you know, car seats and drowning prevention. So why shouldn't I share her with other departments when they do their spiel? Same with our investigations team. I have really good skilled people. We have all the equipment. Why am I going to keep them here? I'll send them to any city that needs them. And the chiefs and the board are okay with that.
So if I have occasion to need ambulance service, if I dial 911 for ambulance service, and something shows up, and I live in Sun City, and something shows up, it's got Peoria on the side of it. I'm not going to get charged any more for Peoria than
I bet you're happy they're there.
Absolutely.
Alan Brunicini said, I don't remember the actual, I won't quote it, but it was something like, Mrs. Smith doesn't care about the color of the truck or the something
exactly.
like that. You know,
exactly.
that you probably don't even know who pulled up in front of your house.
Okay.
But it's, you know, we did the same thing with the investigation show. When I was down in Tulsa, nobody said, I could see some of their firefighters looking at the side of my trailer, said Sun City, but we're there to investigate origin and cause. The Tolleson investigator still does the report. We're just there as, you know, manpower. If we go out, if the private's coming out to do a fire we already did, we'll go out and help them dig back through and give them our thoughts, and we'll collect their thoughts and, you know, come up with a consensus.
Working in Sun City, I imagine you get a lot of calls that are not fire-related.
Correct. Actually, the nation's about 84% EMS.
Okay.
Cross border to border.
So it's 84% are non-fire.
That's kind of a national standard, yeah. For EMS calls, about 84%.
Okay. I want to touch on something about that in a minute, but I also wanted, because I remember one time you were on before, and we talked about a stove fire. And there's a grease fire on the stove, and whether you should start to put it out, how quick it goes into a full conflagration. Why don't you just go ahead and let's kind of revisit that for a minute.
My advice on the stove fires is, once again, if it's really nice to keep a metal baking sheet nearby. You know, if you're going to be doing some stir fry or, you know, some kind of grease on the stove. My suggestion is if you do experience that fire, is you place that steel or metal baking sheet across the top of that pan. You leave the residence, once again, leave the residence, and call 911.
Don't put it in the sink.
Don't run water on it. Don't run around the house with it screaming and hollering. Don't try and grab some homemade fire extinguisher, baking soda mix. Cover it up. We're going to try and deplete it from oxygen and break that chemical chain reaction. Leave the house and call. Because if you pick it up and you get it on you, you're going to drop it. It's going to spread. Very bad things are going to happen.
And then you become the conflagration.
And anytime
yourself.
You have a fire, you need to leave the residence, and you never go back in. Never. I can pull up articles every day of people that left and went back in, and they do not come back out. They die in the fire.
Let's talk about something that is, I would imagine, very prevalent in Sun City because you're dealing with an elderly population, and that's DNR. I think most people know what a DNR is, but from your standpoint, what is a DNR? A. B. What do you do when you get there if that person is unconscious and you don't know whether or not they have a DNR? And then what do you do if somebody says, oh, wait, stop, I found the DNR? How does that all work?
I'll answer best I can. It's probably better left for one of our EMS coordinators. The DNR is a do not resuscitate. That's a form that needs to be filled out by yourself, countersigned by a doctor, and notarized. So there are a couple of elements that people sometimes forget. And no, you can't fill one out for your loved one and sign their name to it. It's not going to work. I did have somebody ask me that. No, that won't work. So We have them at the admin facility. I think the stations may have them too, but it is a form that your doctor's going to go over with you and explain what, and that's why they want a doctor to countersign it. You know, what are the ramifications of having that? Well, you're not going to be treated. If you don't have it, you are. I mean, I'm going to keep it real simple because I'm not, like I said, into the EMS field. The forms are available. They're fairly easy to fill out. If you think you want one, I would not wait until you aren't capable of signing it or understanding what it's saying. That could pose a problem getting it, getting the doctor to sign off on it. But if you have it, that the initials right there tell you what, they're not going to resuscitate. So, like I said, if that's something that you're passionate about, I'd recommend you get it done. You can retract it, obviously. But if you're not in a mental state to understand that, it's probably not going to get completed because they want to talk to you about what that means. Because I think some people think it means, well, if I'm really, really bad off and I have these long-term diseases, then they'll do that. But if it's something minor, then no.
DNR is a DNR.
Yeah. So
if it's in place, it's in place.
Yeah.
Now, here again, this might be something for your EMT folks, but you roll up and through sheer panic and concern and whatever, the spouse is there and the spouse says he or she has got a DNR. They've got a DNR. I can't find it. I don't know where it is. They've got a DNR. What do they do?
My understanding, once again, I'll throw that disclaimer out because I am not an EMS person. My understanding is if it can't be produced, they're going to render aid. I think there's a lot of legalities there if they don't, just
right.
Because somebody is telling you that it exists. I do believe that the medics need to see that to not render aid.
So the key being, in a situation like that, or if that is conceivable that it would happen, is to make sure that DNR is out somewhere and easily accessible, even when you're in a state of panic.
Absolutely.
I mean, yeah. It's just that simple. It's like that vial of life.
Yeah, I mean, that's in the fridge. I would probably put the DNR on the fridge.
Yeah, there you go.
Because there's a good likelihood that they're going to see it when they come in.
And it's a bright orange.
Yeah, and in the vial of life that we do, that actually, it talks about, there's some information that you can fill out on that indicates that you have a DNR and where it's located. So if you don't have a vial of life, I'd probably... We have them. The stations have them. Boswell Hospital usually has a stack of them. You know, if that's your wishes, you should probably make those known to the folks that get there and have to deal with that situation.
These are some EMS questions that are just coming to mind here as off the top of my head. The medic alert bracelets and so on, what... they are absolutely looked for by the EMS people.
Oh, sure. I mean, if you have it and you wear it, they'll read that, try and understand it. And then they can relay that information to the hospital when they're patching over there talking to the doc. Any information you can provide is phenomenal. You know, it's just going to help them if they know your conditions, what medications you're on. They don't have to do, not that they do guesswork, but it certainly can narrow that window of treatment time.
We had a case. I don't know if you're going to like this one either. But we had occasion of somebody we know that was involved in a multi-level marketing situation and about putting your medical history on a thumb drive. And then the theory being that the EMS, fire department, whomever, could take that thumb drive, plug it in their computer, and see that medical history.
I don't know that would happen.
Okay.
And I really, you know, I don't know. You know, I can't speak for our EMS crews, but, you know, I don't know that they have time, first off, to, I don't know that even if they're bringing a laptop in. I mean, we're going back to paper charting and not the electronic charting. There's a huge cost saving to the department. I think you're asking a lot that they're going to bring a laptop into your home and actually have USB ports on it. To plug in the flash drive and then maybe be able to open it. Maybe it's password protected. I don't know. If they can, do they have the right drivers and applications and programs on their device to read your thumb drive. And I teach all over the nation, and I've had plenty of thumb drives that wouldn't open on my laptop. I'm not.
Well, we had somebody else tell us that it's just not an applicable instrument because of all those variables that you just mentioned.
Yeah.
And I know there are some people out there trying to make a buck on that thing as an MLM business. And I was approached on it, and I said,
I think they're going to come in. They come in, try and treat, expedite, package, and go. You know, it's not going to be.
They're not going to sit there and say, I wonder if this is a diabetic attack.
What if you've loaded pictures on your flash drive? I don't know that they're. I would probably venture to say that they're not even going to look at trying to find a device and plug a flash drive in and open it.
Well, this flash drive, you wear it around your neck. It's sort of like...
Yeah, but they still got to have a computer to plug it in.
Well, I know, but I mean, they can readily find it. You know? I mean, that's the sale, you know. It's just sort of
wear a dog tag.
Sort of like your medical alert bracelet.
I think it's
a medical alert pendant that happens to plug into your computer.
Yeah, I don't know about that one. I did see another one. It's more like my watch band, and it's made by... It's a little more applicable for like runners. I think it's like Road ID.
Yes.
But it's got all your information. It's a reflective bracelet, and it's got you can put medical stuff in there. So like if you're in Sun City and you do a lot of walking, or out on a golf cart and you don't want to take a purse or a billfold, that could be a phenomenal idea because it's attached to your wrist. And there's probably several vendors. My wife's a runner, so I'm familiar with that Road ID one. But a lot of the folks that go out and do these, 3, 4, 5, 10, 20 mile runs. That's all they, they just wear shorts and a light shirt, so they have that little Velcro bracelet. That kind of stuff is simple, fast, and easy. Now, plugging a flash drive into a computer to get your medical, I don't know.
It seems silly.
It's a lot of work.
Who's going to upload it onto the thumb drive in the first place? Your doctor going to do that for you?
Yeah.
He's probably got some HIPAA regulations.
HIPAA is a big deal now, yeah.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Well, Ken, as always, it's been a pretty fast hour. About an hour that we've spent visiting. Any closing thoughts with regard to the 4th of July season that we started this whole thing out? Let's wrap it up.
Be safe. Hydrate. If you're going to do the fireworks, please be careful. Monitor your kids. I need to plug we're doing a race October 8th, so I'll get more info on that.
Do it.
10K race, benefit the Foundation for Burns and Trauma. It'll be ran through the wonderful town of Youngstown. I'll bring you some more information on that.
Please do.
Yeah, it'll be wonderful.
Excellent. Well, as always,
my pleasure.
It's always fun and interesting having you here. So thanks again, Ken, for joining us today. As always, our listeners have something to think about. The other thing is make sure your cell phone's charged and you can get to 911 if you want, if you're out and about.
And if they got questions, it's krice@suncityfire.com.
krice@suncityfire.com.
Yeah.
All spelled out.
Okay. Rice, SunCityFire.com.
You've been listening to the Boom and the Babe Show on Blog Talk Radio, where we bring good conversation to the world. Today, we brought you information and conversation with Mr. Ken Rice, Fire Marshal from Sun City Fire Department. And Ken's always here on a regular basis with us from over the course of a year. We'll probably talk to him one or two times. And it's always fun to have him here. So remember that we do much more than just host this radio show. Check us out at BoomerAndTheBabe.com. See everything else that makes up the Boom and the Babe Incorporated. And make sure that the second half of your life is the best half of your life. And if we don't hear from you or talk to you again before then, have a great 4th of July, everybody. Interesting conversations to the world. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, where we tweet as Boomer and Babe, and on Facebook as PeteFeeders47. As always, you can friend us on Blog Talk Radio or sign up for our newsletter at BoomerAndTheBabe.com. Email us at host@BoomerTheBabe.com with any of your comments.
Remember, at 50, you're just getting started.